Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Ahimsa satyamasteya.
Ahimsa satyamasteya.
Yavad artha parigraha.
Yavad artha parigraha.
Brahmacharyam tapashocham.
Brahmacharyam tapashocham.
Swadhyaya purusharchanam.
Swadhyaya purusharchanam.
Ahimsa satyamasteyam.
Ahimsa satyamasteyam.
Yavad artha parigraha.
Yavad artha parigraha.
Brahmacharyam tapashocham.
Brahmacharyam tapashocham.
Swadhyaya
purusharchanam. Swadhyaya purusharchanam.
Ahimsa,
ahimsa,
non-violence,
non-violence,
satya,
satya,
truthfulness,
truthfulness,
asteya,
asteya,
refraining from theft,
refraining from theft,
yavat artha,
yavat artha,
as much as necessary,
as much as necessary,
parigraha,
parigraha,
possessing,
possessing.
Brahmacharya.
Brahmacharya.
Celibacy.
Celibacy.
Tapaha.
Tapaha.
Austerity.
Austerity.
Shaucham.
Shaucham.
Cleanliness.
Cleanliness.
Swadhyaya.
Swadhyaya.
Study of the Vedas.
Study of the Vedas.
Purusha Archana.
Purusha Archana.
Worship of the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Worship of the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. One should practice non-violence and truthfulness, should avoid thieving, and be satisfied with possessing as much as he needs for his maintenance. He should abstain from sex life, perform austerity, be clean, study the Vedas, and worship the Supreme Form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Purport. The word Purusharchanam in this verse means worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead, especially the form of Lord Krishna. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is confirmed by Arjuna that Krishna is the original Purusha, or the Personality of Godhead. Purusham Shashvatam. Therefore, in yoga practice, not only one must concentrate his mind on the person of Krishna, but must also worship the form or deity of Krishna daily. A brahmachari practices celibacy, controlling his sex life. One cannot enjoy unrestricted sex life and practice yoga. This is rascaldom. So-called yogis advertise that one can go on enjoying as he likes and simultaneously become a yogi. But this is totally unauthorized. It is very clearly explained here that one must observe celibacy. Brahmacharyam means that one lives his life simply in relationship with Brahman, or in full Krishna consciousness. Those who are too addicted to sex life cannot observe the regulations that will lead them to Krishna consciousness. Sex life should be restricted to persons who are married. A person whose sex life is restricted in marriage is also called a brahmachari. The word asteyam is also very important for a yogi. Asteya means to refrain from theft. In the broader sense, everyone who accumulates more than he needs is a thief. According to spiritual communism, one cannot possess more than he needs for his personal maintenance. That is the law of nature. Anyone who accumulates more money or more possessions than he needs is called a thief. And one who simply accumulates wealth without spending for sacrifice or for worship of the personality of Godhead is a great thief. Swadhyayaha means reading the authorized Vedic scriptures. Even if one is not Krishna conscious and is practicing the yoga system, he must read standard Vedic literature in order to understand. Performance of yoga alone is not sufficient. Narottam Das Thakur, a great devotee and acharya in the Gaudiya Vaishnav Sampradaya, says that all spiritual activities should be understood from three sources, namely saintly persons, standard scriptures, and the spiritual master. These three guides are very important for progress in spiritual life. The spiritual master prescribes standard literature for the prosecution of the yoga of devotional service, and he himself speaks only from scriptural reference. Therefore, reading its standard scriptures is necessary for executing yoga. Practicing yoga without reading the standard literatures is simply a waste of time. In this chapter, Lord Kapiladev is explaining practical implementation of the principles of yoga, how to practice yoga. Yoga is not just something to study theoretically, it's meant to do. It's a practice. It's like you can read about athletics, but sports are actually meant to be played, not just to be read about. It's not that interesting. People, for some reason, are fascinated to read the cricket scores, you know, who got so how many centuries and this and that, and all the statistics. But the real excitement of a game is to play it. It's just those who can't play, they just read the statistics. But what's the fun really in that? Just numbers. So yoga also is a participation sport. It's not just meant to be understood theoretically. The practice of spiritual discipline of how to unite yourself with the Supreme is not something you just study like they do in the academic world, in the universities. They study these things theoretically. Professor so-and-so in such-and-such university is an expert on the yoga system. He knows everything that's said in all the books. In Sanskrit, in Tibetan, in English, he knows all the books. But he's never done any of it. He doesn't know what the real experience is because he's never done it. He's never practiced it. He just knows it theoretically. What use is that? He's a big fool. Big expert, and he actually doesn't really know anything about it because he's never actually practiced it. Like someone who's expert in military science but has never fought a battle, never been in war. What does he know? He doesn't know what it's actually like to be in battle. But he's a big expert, so-called. So yoga is meant to be done, not just to be studied theoretically. It's a discipline, a practice. And in the very first verse, Lord Kapiladev, because there may be different systems of yoga that have somewhat different goals and different methods, definitely different methods. So Kapiladev, in the first verse, defines what this yoga is aiming at, what the goal of it is, what the purpose of it is. And then the rest of the chapter, he describes the means, the methods. So the definition he gives, in the first verse, the personality of Godhead said, "My dear mother, O daughter of the king, now I shall explain to you this system of yoga, the object of which is to concentrate the mind." Well, that's very general. Yoga in general should involve that. In fact, in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, the definition is yoga indriya samyamaha. Yoga means to bring the mind, the senses under control. The Prabhupada says, and Kapiladev says, concentrate the mind. It's saying, Same idea. You control your senses in order to concentrate your mind. Yoga, the Indriya Samyama leads to Dhyanam, Dharana, Samadhi. Dharana, Dhyanam, Samadhi. Concentration of the mind, deep meditation, and finally complete mystic trance. This is the purpose. This is what you gain, this is what you accomplish by controlling the senses. You gain mastery of the mind. The real objective, just like again in a battle, in a war, you may say the objective is to capture that hill. But we're not just interested in the hill. What's the use of that hill? Nobody cares for the hill. There's a few goats live on it. But the objective of the battle, we win the battle if we get that hill. Because that's just an immediate goal. The ultimate goal is to win the war, to defeat the enemy and make them surrender, and gain victory over the whole country. Not just get that little hill. So there's an immediate objective, but there's an ultimate objective. That's the real goal. So in yoga, yes, controlling the senses is the first goal. But that's just the immediate objective. That's capturing the hill. But the winning the war is to capture the mind. That's the real objective, is the mind. Senses are just second intermediate objective. Anyway, okay. Kapiladeva, I interrupted Kapiladeva, excuse me. He says, "My dear mother, O daughter of the king, now I shall explain to you the system of yoga, the objective of which is to concentrate the mind." All right, that's general. Then he says, "By practicing this system, one can become joyful and progressively advance toward the path of the absolute truth." And then he starts to describe what you can actually do to implement, to practice yoga. And this is the fourth verse that we're reading today. These are basic preliminary practices. Anyone who wants to engage in any serious spiritual discipline, whether it is meditational yoga or performance of ritual sacrifices or study of the Vedic literature or giving of charity or doing various pious works, like building temples, building roads, and watering places, different auspicious welfare works. Whatever your concept of spiritual discipline is, these basics must be practiced. There's no spiritual life of any form without these basics. The basics are what makes you a civilized human being rather than an uncivilized person who's no better than an animal. Dharmena hina pashubhya samhada. Human beings who don't have any proper concept of spiritual life, spiritual obligation, dharma, they are no better than animals. They're dvipara pashu, two-legged animals. A human being has a sense of spiritual responsibility. And therefore, he practices at least these basic things. So, the previous two verses were already starting to list these, and here is a continuation of the list. Nonviolence, truthfulness, not being a thief, taking only what you need, practicing celibacy, austerity, or taking trouble for a spiritual purpose. Being clean, studying the Vedas, and worshipping the Supreme Lord. These are all important things. But anybody who wants to practice any real spiritual discipline cannot avoid these.
Parigraha means?
Parigraha means accepting or taking. There's two opposites, dana and parigraha. A Brahmana has six occupational activities. Two of them that are complementary are giving charity and taking charity. And taking charity is called parigraha, taking something for yourself. Dana is the opposite, giving something to somebody else. So for every person that gives, there's somebody who has to receive. It's a reciprocal activity. If someone's giving, then someone must be receiving. So the giving is called dana, the receiving is called parigraha. Taking something from somebody else. But you should only take as much as you need. you need something to eat. You need food to buy, money to buy food. How will you get money? By taking it from somebody else. You know, you're not going to go and dig in the earth and find gold and then mint your own gold coins or print your own, 500 rupee notes. That's illegal. If you print your own money, you're a counterfeit and should go to jail. No, to get money, you have to do something that will cause someone else to give you the money out of his wallet. You work for somebody, as an employee, he gives you money. Or you do some business deal with somebody and you make a profit. To get money, you have to take it away from somebody else. So that taking from somebody is called parigraha. It's the opposite of giving to somebody. You shouldn't take away something from somebody else unless you really need it. You can take what you need, but if you take more than you need, as Prabhupada says in the purport, you're called a thief. Yavad arta parigraha, only taking as much as you require. This is a very tricky principle. Even persons who are otherwise very serious about spiritual life run into trouble on this question. How much do I need? I have a family to maintain. How do I have to maintain them? Can I keep them in a simple house? Or do I have to build a mansion? Do I have to work, you know, like a dog, day and night, all my life, and engage in cutthroat business in order to take money from other people? How much money do I need? There's one story by Leo Tolstoy. I don't remember the Russian. I guess I read this one in English. I read some of Tolstoy in Russian, but this I read in English. How much land does a man need? I don't know if that's the exact name of the story. This is an illustrative question of how much do you need?
You know, it's an essay?
Yes?
It's like an essay?
It's a story. Yes? No. This is a story. It's only about 10 pages long.
Yeah.
Anyway, man was very. He had some land, but he was greedy to get more. And he worked real hard and bought some more land. But he wasn't satisfied with that. He wanted more land and more land. And then he found out from a friend that this tribe, I think it's the Bashkirs or somebody, will give away land for free. If you just go to them as a guest, and if you please them, they'll offer you land. And maybe a lot of land. They won't even ask for money. They're just very hospitable. So he went to this part of the country where these tribal people lived. And he made friends with them. And yes, they offered him land. He said, yeah, look out at this countryside. We have so much land. We'll make you an offer. You just walk all day, as far as you want. And whatever land you cover by your walking, before sunset, you can have all that land. You know, so very early in the morning, he started walking over the hills to cover as much ground as he could, you know, to circumambulate a big piece of land for himself. He thought, I'll become rich. I'll walk as hard as I can and cover a large amount of land. And he was thinking about how he'll prosper with all this land. All day he was thinking about it, and he was getting very tired. And then he didn't realize. He was thinking and obsessed about his success. He didn't realize it was getting late. Almost sunset.
How would I do?
You know, and he hadn't really wanted to cover it, but, you know, real, and come back to the same point. So he actually encircled the land. He wasn't quite to the point he wanted to reach, to make an enclosed big area. And the sun was about to set. And he pushed himself and pushed himself and pushed himself. And finally it was sunset, and he dropped dead right on the spot. Right in the right spot. He got the circumambulated, but he was dead from exhaustion. So, Tolstoy, the author, says, okay, so what's the answer to the question? That was the name of the story. How much land does a man need?
And they also made a television production on this.
They did?
Yeah.
Okay, but the answer is, the punchline, the answer at the end of the story is, 6 feet for his grave, that's all he needs. The man dropped dead. He got all the land, but he died. So all he needed was 6 feet of land to dig a grave for him in the end.
Probably, but in a different context.
Yes.
In fact, we saw a family, being a doctor, the women family we know of. Actually, all of them became HIV positive because of the intravenous route or whatever.
Yes.
Now, it was a very, very affluent family, and all wealth is lost in the treatment, something which you cannot anticipate. So keeping these circumstances in mind, in fact, we can say that the sky is the limit. You can never predict how much you're going to need.
Well,
so how do you...
you're presenting the argument that better you acquire all the wealth you can.
No, I am not.
Because you never know what you're going to have to spend.
Yeah, but then what is the saving for those rainy days? What is that?
It's selfishness. Yeah. Yes. It's not... Okay, I'll have to... I mean, that would require some explanation to answer that properly. I can't answer in just one sentence. It's not... See, the principle is not being taught that you should take nothing. Or you should be stingy, or you should be negligent of your obligations to your family and others. It says take what you need. The intelligence is required. The intelligence has to be acquired to be able to decide what you actually need and how much is too much. I would say in the case of the family who all came down with HIV virus that this is a sinful reaction. People don't like to hear this. That it's a sinful reaction for illicit sex or illicit drug use. But it is. You don't have horrible things happen to you unless you've done something bad to earn it. People who suffer great misfortunes have earned that by their past activities. And here's a whole family who must have done something wrong. And rich people have a tendency to be greedy. They don't become rich, usually, by being overly generous. But by being selfish and greedy, that's how you usually become rich. There's exceptions. But if you take the statistics, a lot of rich people are also greedy and selfish. It's a lot easier to become rich if you're greedy and selfish. It's hard to become rich if you're too generous and kind to everybody. There's exceptions. So I would guess, I don't know this family, but I would guess that they had this problem. They were really greedy and selfish people. And
there's so many of them.
I don't know them, so I don't want to unfairly judge them. So I would suggest, if they had to live their lives over again, better not be greedy, and maybe you wouldn't have had this thing happen to you in the first place. If you'd been nice people, maybe God wouldn't have struck you down like that. So I don't think it's a good argument that we should have been even greedier because we ran out of money with our medical treatment. We should have made more money. No, you should have been decent people, and then you wouldn't have gotten sick. Maybe really cruel to say that. I don't even know these people, and I'm judging them unfairly. But just theoretically, I would answer like that.
But then, coming back to our own scenario, we don't know our past karmas. But let's say something that
happens. This is the problem. How do we know how much we need? Very often, devotees, especially devotee grihasthas who have complicated lives, brahmacharis, they have to worry whether, do I need, three pairs of socks? Maybe I need four or five. These are the problems a brahmachari has. Simple problems. But a grihastha has got real questions. How much do I have to worry about getting my daughter married to a rich man? How much do I have to worry about, my son has to get to get into IIT? How much do I have to worry about these things? Or can I live a simple life and concentrate more on spiritual things? How much materialistic do I have to be to fulfill my obligations? This is a tricky question for a devotee, especially a devotee grihastha. Hard to answer. Very hard to answer. That's why Prabhupada points out in the purport that we should take guidance from Guru Shastra and Sadhu. Without the support, the guidance we can get from the revealed scriptures, from the spiritual masters, and from the other devotees of the Lord, it's very hard to decide what's appropriate and what's too much, what we actually need in life. Better to take guidance and counsel from those who are more experienced and advanced in devotional service, who've lived through these things, or have helped other people live through them, and have a sense, a practical sense of what's appropriate, what isn't. Really tricky questions. That's why we should take help and guidance in deciding them. Krishna tells Arjuna, Tasma Shastram Pramanamte Karya Karya Vivastita Gyatva Shastra Vidanoktam Karyam Kartam Viharasi. You should be very careful in deciding Krishna tells Arjuna in this world what you should do and what you should not do. Very important decisions. And you should use the revealed scripture, the Shastra, as your guide in making these decisions. Like, okay, how do we, what's appropriate to eat? Many people think it's okay to eat meat. You know, their family does it, or you live in a country where everybody eats meat, and it's considered weird and abnormal to be a vegetarian. Many countries are like this, where you're practically an outcast if you're trying to be a vegetarian. So, how do you decide and how do you argue what's appropriate? Is it appropriate to eat the flesh of other animals? Is it not? On what basis do you decide that? And even among the vegetarians, there's controversies. Some vegetarians will eat meat, will eat eggs, thinking that you're not killing anybody. If it's an unfertilized egg, what's the problem? Why not eat eggs? And some vegetarians are so strict they won't touch milk products because it's an animal product. They won't drink milk or anything made from milk products. Well, here we are in the middle, Krishna's devotees, and we won't touch eggs, I hope. Yeah. Some people call them Ram Ladu. Yeah. And some people call it, in Bengal, some people call the, maybe in Bihar also, I don't know. People call the fish Ganga Phal. Yeah. Ganga Phal. Yeah, fish, the muchly. So, we're very strict about that. We won't touch fish or eggs, you know. This is, we want to be vegetarians. Because Krishna wants us to be vegetarians. But we do take milk products. We offer them to Krishna. And we're not against drinking milk or all the hundreds of things you can make from milk. In fact, that's a major part of our culture. This is, we're worshipping and trying to follow in the footsteps of the devotees of Vrajana, Vrindavan, where the people are gwalas, they're cowherds, and their whole livelihood is based on the production of milk products and consumption of them. Yeah. So how can we, as Krishna's devotees, be against milk products? The vegans are, they're against any animal products, including milk. So why are we taking that stand and not one extreme or the other? Why don't we accept eggs or why do we accept milk? The answer is Shastra. We follow the scripture. And especially we follow the scripture where Krishna gives his own opinion, what he wants to be offered. First of all, he says in the Gita, Krishna says, Yagishishtashino santa vuchante sarvakilbishai. The devotees, saintly devotees of the Lord, they're relieved of all sinful reactions because they offer everything they eat to the Lord first. They cook for the Lord's pleasure and they offer everything before they eat it to Krishna and ask him to eat it first. Bunjite te togam papam ye pachantyatma karana. On the other hand, those who cook for themselves are verily eating only sin, even if they're vegetarians. This is Krishna's statement. People who cook for themselves are eating only sin. It doesn't say non-vegetarians who cook for themselves. Even vegetarians who cook for themselves are eating only sin because they don't offer it to Krishna. They don't offer it to God first. And they don't cook it for God. They cook it for themselves. That's Krishna's statement. That's Shastra. This is not only Shastra, but it's God himself talking in the Shastra. And then later in the Gita he says, Patram pushpam palam toyam yome bhaktya prayachati. Taraam bhakti uparitam oshnami prayatatmanaha. If a devotee offers me with love, prayata atmanaha. Simple things. Fruit, flower, leaf, water. Of course, this is not the whole extent of Krishna's menu. He doesn't eat only leaves and water and some uncooked fruits. Krishna eats nicer than that. And traditionally in the mandirs and in the homes, the devotees of Krishna offer him much more opulent things than just raw fruit and a glass of water and a couple of dry leaves. What is it? What's the other one? Leaf, fruit, water. patron, pushman, flower. They offer a couple of flowers, and that's it. No, of course not. If you're really serious about pleasing Krishna, you offer him all sorts of nice things to eat and to enjoy. But he's sort of giving the guidelines. This is the kind of things you should offer to me. First
Does
of all,
he eat flowers.
Yes.
Does he eat flowers?
No, he doesn't eat the flowers. That's offered. Flowers are offered for Krishna to smell and to look at, you know, not to eat. Sometimes a devotee in his enthusiasm may eat the shadow, but Krishna doesn't eat the flowers normally. Yeah.
And the leaf?
Leaf can mean leafy vegetables. Yeah. It also means the tulsi patta. Krishna will not accept an offering where the tulsi leaf has not also been put on the offering. Yeah. And water can mean all sorts of liquids. And so what he's talking about is categories of food. Vegetables, fruits, milk products, like that. These are the things that Krishna accepts. He never says, offer me fish, offer me eggs. Now, Krishna, and elsewhere in other shastras, Gita he's not more specific about it, but elsewhere he is more specific, or others speaking for Krishna are explaining what is the proper thing to offer to Krishna. There are many shastras, scriptures that explain what we should offer to the deity of Krishna. And it's a general consensus, there's no controversy about it among Vaishnavas, that we don't offer fish and eggs to Krishna. Is there any Vaishnav community anywhere where they offer fish and eggs to Krishna? Even in the Jagannath temple, where the pujaris themselves may be eating fish, they don't offer it to Jagannath. They haven't gone that bad. They may in their own homes eat fish, but they don't offer it to Jagannath fish. Nowhere does any Vaishnava try to offer fish and eggs to Krishna. Everybody understands from the scriptures, so many scriptures explaining these things, what you should offer to Krishna, what you shouldn't offer. But nobody says, don't offer any milk to Krishna, it's bad for you. Milk is poisonous, it comes from an animal, or it's bad karma. Nowhere does any Vaishnava say, don't offer rasgullas and sandesh and dahi to Krishna. Nobody says that.
Yeah. I was watching a puppet show.
Yes.
Where one fisherman, in fact, is singing Narasingha Aarti.
Yes.
And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu suddenly goes in a trance and is actually into the river, and he gets him out. The fisherman gets him out.
Yes.
This is a fisherman, and he actually gets to touch Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
Yes.
And get him ashore. Now, he's having this mercy to touch the Lord himself.
That is the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
So, what is this benediction?
It doesn't mean that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu didn't accept any fish from him. He didn't come go, so let me go to your house and eat some fish with you. He didn't do that.
Then he's shown as a very pious devotee.
He made him into a pure devotee. He transformed that man. He was sinful before. At least he was low class. He was not up to standard. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would not go eat in the house, in a non-vegetarian house. He only ate in houses of very strict brahmanas. He gave his mercy to low-class people. He didn't eat in their houses. About what devotee should eat, he was very strict. We should give our mercy to all the fish eaters and the hamburger eaters and the mutton eaters. We should go out in the city and give Krishna's mercy to everybody. Because that's what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did. He gave his mercy to the fallen and unqualified. And we should do that too. It's not that we're only going to preach to the Pakka Brahmins here in Delhi. All 10 of them. we can preach to everybody. To the meat eaters and the sex mongers and the drunkards, we preach to everybody. We don't go and share their bad habits. We don't drink and eat with them. But we invite them to come to our temple and we'll give you, anybody comes. We don't say, you're a meat eater, we can't let you in our mandir. We never say that. If they want to bring the meat into the temple, we won't allow that. But as long as they don't eat meat on the premises, or don't drink whiskey on the premises, then they're allowed in. And we give them prasadam. Here, eat with us. Come and take some pure Krishna prasadam. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave his mercy to that fisherman and then made him into a pure devotee immediately. But it doesn't mean he agreed with the fisherman's habits that, yes, a person should live like this. He should eat fish. He should, hunt for fish and eat them. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu didn't approve of that.
Prabhuji, what about the Muslims who extend an argument that they are doing as per the scriptures? They are killing the animals and then offering it to Allah and then saying Bismillah and then eating it. They say it's in the scriptures and whatever they're doing is as per the scriptures.
And our answer is yes. If you follow the injunction of scripture and make a proper ritual offering, then you can go ahead and eat your meat. Then we don't consider you criminal, although it's up to Yamaraj whether he wants, you know, that. We're not deciding for Yamaraj whether you're going to be punished. But at least you can be allowed to do that. And then you'll have to deal with Yamaraj, you know, and account to him later on. But the offering must be made. You have to... in the Vedas, it's also allowed. Meat eating is allowed, according to the Vedic injunctions. But there's a ritual you have to perform. You're allowed on the new moon night to offer a goat, not a cow. You can't kill a cow. That's not allowed. But you can kill a goat or some other lower animal. You want to kill a dog, maybe, or a goat, or a sheep. And you have to make an offering. Traditionally, an offer to Kali, but I don't know if that's the Vedic injunction. You have to make a sacrificial offering. And you have to make a mantra into the ear of the animal before you kill it. That I'm killing you now, I'm sorry. Next life you can come and kill me like I'm killing you. This is part of the ritual. And therefore, the grammarians say, therefore the word for meat is mamsa.
Yes.
Mamsa. Meat. Mamsa, Sanskrit. I think you also have the word meat, you know? Mamsa. Mam sakadishyati iti mamsaha. Mamsa kadishyati. He will eat me. He's going to eat me. That's mamsa. Your meat is going to eat you in the next life. He's going to kill you and eat you for dinner next time around. If you do the ritual and make that promise to your victim, then you can go ahead and do it. Then it's not sinful according to the Vedas. You can even eat meat once a month. You know, on the dark moon night, making that sacrificial offering, but making a promise that you can come and kill me next time, next life, and eat me. And if you're smart, after doing that, you think, is that really a good deal? Would I really want to do that? I want to oblige myself to be killed next life just so I can have a hamburger? So an intelligent person will realize, that it's, it's foolish to indulge in this, but still it's allowed under strict injunctions.
Probably they say they don't reap any sin because it's in the scriptures. The Muslims?
Yes, and they can. And we say, yes, follow your Muslim religion. Follow it, and we won't condemn you for it. Not for us to criticize. Then you can answer, at the end of your life, you can answer to Allah and explain your deeds to Him. And if He's satisfied with you, that's between you and Him. So we're not going to condemn someone for following his own religion. We don't condemn sex. We don't even condemn meat eating if it's done according to religious principles. Like Kshatriya, to practice his fighting, he has to go out in the forest and kill certain animals. He has to do it. He has to practice fighting. So he has to use his weapons against animals and practice. So if the Kshatriya kills a rabbit and then eats the flesh, we don't consider that that's not sinful for him. That's his duty, to practice his fighting skills. But it has to be within the religious principles that a person is following. A grihastha can have sex to have and beget children, but a brahmachari should never have sex.
What about those guinea pigs for me, which have been used in research?
That's not necessary. My sister works as genetic engineer. And she works at a company where they develop bacteria that can be used in experimentation instead of vivisection, instead of killing animals. And, it's not necessary. If it's absolutely necessary to save lives, okay. If you have to kill an animal to save a human being, that can be justified. But if it's not necessary, don't do it.
Justify on the flimsiest of grounds, because they can say a student, in fact, in the early years of schooling has to be shown the basic anatomical features and things like that. So for that also you need to dissect. How will you do that otherwise? how will you appreciate the...
To find an animal that's died naturally.
You won't get cadavers, probably.
You won't?
Where would you go and find mice cadavers?
Mice cadavers?
Where would you go to find them? You have to get like...
Mice are dying all the time. My animals and mice live. A mouse lives for a couple of months. There are plenty of dead mice. if there are cats around, they're killing mice. So ask a cat for a dead mouse. They'll give you one. Dead mice can be found. maybe not the millions of them that they need for their experiments, but if they adjust their instead of killing millions of guinea pigs, be satisfied with a few dead mice that you find in the corners. Just be reasonable. There are civilizations where unnecessary killing of animals has been avoided without great harm to the progress of human society. Human society can progress without unnecessary violence. It can.
We were given some 100 animals in the space of 2 days.
Yes.
All we had to do was just demonstrate, sever the abdomen and show the organs.
Yes.
And that was the end of that life. So 100 lives born in 2 days.
Yes.
Absolutely no use. Not required at all. But
not required.
Required to do it.
It's
because the curriculum.
It's unnecessary violence. But our modern culture is based on violence.
Curriculum wants it, probably. If you don't do it, they would fail you. So what do you do?
Unfortunate. Yeah. Anyway, you have to do your duty even if it is imperfect, even if it is sinful. Arjuna was complaining. You want me to kill my guru? You're being asked to kill a few rats. Arjuna was asked to kill, Bhima and Drona, Bhishma and Drona, the most civilized human beings, and his own gurus. And he, and Krishna wanted him to kill them. And kill not only them, but hundreds of friends and relatives. Thousands. Arjuna was responsible for personally killing them. But Krishna told him, Shreyansu Dharmo Viguna, even though there's fault in your duty, it's better to do your own duty than shirk it and pretend that you're going to do somebody else's duty. If you can change your duty, that's okay. But if you can't, if you're stuck with it, then you just do it, even though there's fault. Then you have to offer it to Krishna. You have to offer everything to Krishna, especially if there's some fault in your activity. Then your only hope is Krishna's protection.
There's one. I'll ask a question in my
interview. Go ahead.
I was reading one article where they said that more killing, in fact, has been done in the name of religion. If I take across centuries and all together and say that any form of war, in fact, Islam is warranting war because all kafirs have to be destroyed.
Yes.
Now, Allah is the supreme personality of Lord. Hazrat Muhammad is a prophet, and he has been saying that all kafirs are basically to be killed and violence has to be done.
I don't think he tells us. I don't think if you study the Quran, or you ask someone who's a real expert in the Quran, who's studied it fairly and really looked at it deeply, I don't think you'll find Allah saying you have to kill all the faithless. It's not the real principles, and even historically it's not the real principles of Islam. Historically, in the high civilization of Islam, when there were really pious kings, people who were not Muslims were protected. The Jews and the Christians and others who were under the Muslim subjugation were allowed to practice their religions. Northern Africa and other places where there were established, kingdoms in Spain when the Moors took over, the Jews and the Christians were not all slaughtered. They were allowed to practice their religion. And they had to pay extra taxes. They had some unfair treatment, but still they were allowed to live their lives. So it's not the actual teachings of Islam that all the non-Muslims have to be killed. Not at all. That's a perversion. That's a misapplication. It also says that it's a strict principle of Islam, although Islam is a militant religion. They want to have a holy war to propagate Islam, but innocent people should never be killed in war. That's a strict principle of Islam. Women and other innocent people should not be victims of war. It's sinful. So this terrorism is totally against the actual principles of Islam.
The moment we say they're faithless, and when we talk about Bhagavad Gita, we're saying that all those who have been killed are in fact adharmis.
We say that also.
So adharmis and is in the same group. So
no, but it's one thing to condemn somebody philosophically and say he's a two-legged animal. It's another thing to actually do violence to him. You know, if we speak sharply, we're just telling the awful truth that he's a human being living like an animal. And we may speak very unkindly about him. That's just words. You know, I'm not actually doing violence to him, not physical violence. I'm not killing him or depriving him of his freedom. But I'm speaking the harsh truth. You know, that's one thing. And certainly you can expect that people who have different religious principles are always going to be quarreling with one another. But as long as it's just a verbal fight, that's normal and to be expected. It's when it turns into physical violence, depriving people of their lives and their freedom, that's misapplication. And it's always given a bad name to religion. That's the history of Kali Yuga. The history of Kali Yuga, that the religion degenerates into hypocrisy. You know, that is Kali Yuga. The modern age is that people, the people who proclaim or are supposed to be the religious leaders are usually the most degraded. And they're just hypocrites. And they're committing, in the name of peace and love, they're committing the most violence. That's not religion in general. That's the history of the modern age. Is that even religion becomes a sham. Ekali kali nahi kon dharma. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's judgment is that in this Kali Yuga there is no religion, religiosity. Everything is just hypocrisy. And that's what people are seeing. That in the name of religion, so many people have been killed. It's true. Religion has been given a bad name because of how it's been mispracticed. And they're right, it's true. It has been like that.
It's just about comparing Mahabharata with other wars. Because Mahabharata also, it's such a gory battle that Krishna says that apart from you, Pandavas, everyone will be killed.
And Krishna wanted it to happen like that.
And similarly, they say that it's the God's commandment also. Let's say Allah's and whosoever, that fearless, the faithless, in fact, should all be killed. So,
but Krishna told Arjuna to kill the enemy soldiers, those who had come to the battlefield of their own volition. Although they felt obligation to fight on Duryodhana's side, still they decided to fight for Duryodhana. And Krishna told Arjuna, kill the opponent warriors. He didn't tell him to attack, go back to Hastinapur and kill all the women and children and kill non-combatants. Never said that. You know, so it's not the same thing that Krishna told Arjuna to kill his enemies on the battlefield. Or someone saying, well, the same thing that God told me to become a terrorist. Not the same thing. So holy war is one thing. The Mahabharata war is a holy war, jihad. Yeah. But it's unholy war when you're slaughtering innocent people, non-combatants. No?
I had one comment on this statement.
Yes.
It was said that the fight against the faithless, that is actually a fight against the evils within the heart, that is considered more important than the fight against the actual physical people outside.
Yes.
That was in the actual Quran. People who studied it, they have said that.
Yes.
It said inside, to fight the battles and evils inside is more important than fighting the people on the outside.
Well, if all the Muslims thought like that, we wouldn't have any problem with them. Some of the Muslims think they should kill us. and you could also say that Arjuna could have argued with Krishna like that. You know, why are you asking me to shoot arrows at Bhima and Drona? I should just kill the demons in their heart. I'll just preach to them. But I don't think that would have satisfied Krishna. Krishna wanted Arjuna to get up and fight and to kill his gurus.
depends
on the circumstance. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu doesn't want to take the same strategy for a very simple reason, is that if he was going to start killing everyone who had under demoniac influence, he'd have to kill everybody. And, you know, that kind of strategy, that kind of pastime will be exhibited by Kalki, you know, in 327,000 years. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, it's not his mood. Therefore, he never lifted a finger. He once called his Sudarshan Chakra to kill Jagayan Madai, but Nityananda Prabhu stopped him. So that's the only time he almost got violent. Otherwise, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would, you know, never use his weapons against any enemies, because he would have had to kill everybody if he got into that.
This doesn't become clear, in fact, because when we hear our ISKCON acharyas, they at all times have been telling us that we should respect all religion. But when you find so many discrepancies, then it becomes almost impossible that you appreciate the nuances of all religion and then respect them, because we know that things that they are holding, in fact, are...
The practical principle, I think it was taught by Jesus, should hate the sin and not the sinner. We should argue against the hypocrisy, but we shouldn't... you know, condemn the individual. He's just a victim of illusion.
But then they say it's there in the scripture, so how do we take it as a sin? Because the scripture is warranting the killing of those animals. You halal them and then you eat them.
Yes. So,
and then they say that they have reasons also, because they're doing it...
No, but then Prabhupada actually said, okay, you follow your Quran, you slaughter the animal, but you must follow the injunctions of the Quran to the T, and make a proper offering. Then we won't condemn you for it. That would probably allow that. You know, that a pious Muslim can follow his scripture and make his offering and eat his flesh. But not to open factory slaughterhouses to kill millions of animals by a procedure of just blind violence. You kill the animals one at a time and do it in make a sacred ritual out of it. Do it with your own hands, not just go to the meat market and buy the meat. You actually go through the trouble of shedding the blood yourself and make an offering. Then you can be allowed to do that. And Prabhupada said that.
And they say that doing it to preserve the food chain. Otherwise, the balance will not go haywire and there will be animals around. And the book that we read, which comes in, is called Divine Earth.
Yes.
In fact, portraying just the opposite. To keep a cattle alive. And we need, in fact, to keep an animal.
Kill more animals. Kill more cows.
16, in fact, cattle are required to feed just one person. And the statistics are altogether different, Babaji. They will simply merge and it's even altogether different.
It's not, anyway, I don't think their arguments are even practical. You know, the economy of meat eating is not practical. You have to squander resources of the earth in order to maintain a meat diet.
That is what our books said, Divine Earth.
Not only our books, scientists and others are saying
this. They have different statistics. They say that we're doing it to preserve food chain, otherwise the world will be...
But I don't think if they went to the actual ecologists and the biologists, whether their arguments would stand up to expert scrutiny. You know, I think the experts would have to agree.
Even they have the experts, but they are in the...
Okay, but these are practical arguments. You can see the reactions. You can see practically reactions. The countries where the most animals are being killed are the countries that are suffering the most violence.
Probably, is this true? I was told at one of the lectures in one of the counseling sessions by one of the devotees, he said that because they're killing animals and the religion is not next to perfect. So he said that except for our religion, there is no salvation in other religions. A Christian cannot get salvation, a Muslim cannot get salvation.
What do you mean by salvation? If salvation means
moksha.
Perfection? Yeah, moksha.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to get moksha. Hindus also. Hindus also cannot get moksha. In Kali Yuga, all the religions are perverted or not being followed properly. And
what he said
practically nobody can get moksha, and I agree to that.
Even if practiced to perfection, even if they look...
Nobody is practicing anywhere.
Even if done, theoretically speaking, he said, the salvation is not for them. What, at the most, they can expect us to have a Hindu life and then get salvation. This was what was told to me. Is this correct?
Well, I don't know what's the sense of the argument, even if they do it perfectly, because they're not going to do it perfectly. In the modern age, no one is going to do the rituals and the religious observances perfectly. You know, there are going to be so many discrepancies. So
Saint Luke, Saint Bartholomew, Mother Teresa, etc. Nobody gets Paramdham.
Paramdham. Paramdham is rarely achieved. Actual liberation is rarely achieved. You know, you have to become perfect. And we're so imperfect in this modern age. We're lucky that we're not going straight to hell in our next life. We're lucky if we can keep ourselves as human beings in the next life and not become animals. You know, a majority of people in the modern world are headed for animal bodies because of the disgusting, abominable ways they live. You know, so what to speak of who's getting liberation? How many people are even going to be human beings again in the next life, the way they're living? That's the modern age. You have to look at the real situation. Theoretically, if someone does everything perfect, why shouldn't he get liberation? Sure, he can have it, but who's going to do everything perfect in the modern age?
All those who have been conferred sainthood, I think they have been...
Saints are pretty rare. Real saints are very rare.
So you, let's say they have been, so...
Yeah.
Is there...
There are real saints in many different communities of the world. There are different saints, real saints in various religions, and they're the exceptions.
So they are getting liberation. Is his what he said?
I wouldn't say that a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim cannot get liberation. I wouldn't say that.
It's very rare
anyway for anyone, including Hindus and even Vaishnavas, to actually earn liberation. It's such a rare thing in the modern age.
It came in ISKCON.
I won't say just ISKCON, but I will agree to this. That without the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, it is impossible to make any real advancement in spiritual life. Yeah. This is pretty much what Krishnadas Kaviraj says in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. If you read the first chapters of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, I think in the first chapter of the Adi Lila, he says anyone who does not have faith in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and be confident that he is the Supreme Lord Krishna himself, who thinks that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is just an ordinary human being, he cannot, even if he's a devotee of Krishna, he cannot make any substantial advancement in his spiritual life. And that means that as a devotee of Krishna, he may be able to avoid falling down into a lower species. He may take his next birth again as a human being, or even as a Vaishnava. But he can't make any real progress, further progress toward Krishna. It's like treading water. You're not drowning, but you're not going anywhere. And how long can you keep that up? Not getting out of the water. Eventually you will drown. So that is what I would say. Just following what Krishna's coverage says. If you're not a faithful devotee of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, if you don't have faith in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, that he's Krishna himself, then you're not making any advancement in spiritual life. What to speak of liberation? You're not even moving forward. What to speak of reaching the end? You're not even going in the right direction. You're just standing still. If not going backwards, at least you're just at best standing still. That's the opinion of Krishna's coverage. So I wouldn't say there's nobody outside of ISKCON, but outside of the community of those who believe in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, yes, no real progress. That's a strong statement, but I wouldn't make it stronger than that. I wouldn't say that only the ISKCON devotees can have salvation. That's a little too fanatic. And it's not what we hear from our Shastra, and it's not what Prabhupada said. Prabhupada didn't say that either. Right? But that's still strong. That unless you want to be a devotee of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and accept him as the Supreme Lord, then your spiritual life is going nowhere. Maybe you're not degrading, but you're not getting better.
Because when Prabhupada was being interviewed, he sent a simple statement. Because the interviewer asked him, doesn't it contradict with other religions? All Prabhupada had to say was, no, it doesn't, because there are only cultural differences, and the aim of all religion is to love God.
Yes.
Now, we have a 9-step process where we can continue going in love for the God. If you read Bible, in fact, there are none. All he's saying is that you can love everyone is through all his people only. No ways to love God per se, like the way we have been doing Shravanam.
Well, Jesus did say you should love God with all your heart.
Heart, mind and soul, but how?
Yes.
That process is not explained.
Well, okay, so Christianity is like, you know, the teachings of Christianity is like a pocket dictionary. There's information in there about words, but the unabridged, you know, 13-volume Oxford English Dictionary will give you a lot more information. So the Vedic literature is a lot much more voluminous and much more information about the details of spiritual life. But the basics are there in the Bible and the Quran. Basic principles are there. It's just not as in-depth and not as thorough. Okay? We can accept them as bona fide religions, originally, you know, revelation of God. But all religions in Kali Yuga get corrupted in practice, including especially Hinduism. Okay?
All right, Krishna.
Okay, so I guess we stop here. Yeah, thank you. All glory to Srila Prabhupada, Srila Bhagavatam.